Hi, I'm Jeremy Schwartz, host of American Criminal. In our latest season, the child of Italian immigrants sets out to achieve the American dream. And if he has to spill some blood along the way, so be it. Listen to American Criminal, Al Capone, wherever you get your podcasts. Or to get ad-free access to the entire season first, subscribe at IntoHistory.com.
It's September 22nd, 1842, on a small island in the Mississippi River. Two men stand facing each other, grasping broadswords at their sides, James Shields and Abraham Lincoln. The armed men are prepared to duel for their honor in the early morning chill. Shields was offended by several recent letters to the editor, which appeared in the Sangamo Journal, insulting letters for which Lincoln claims credit, although two were actually penned by his close friend and future wife, Mary Todd. Lincoln is here to protect her from public scorn. Shields steps forward and calls out,
"I require a full retraction of all offensive allusions used by you in these communications."
Lincoln might have apologized before now, but Shields' September 17th note demanding that Lincoln withdraw his printed barbs was itself insulting.
"I am wholly opposed to dueling and would do anything to avoid it that might not degrade me in the estimation of myself and my friends. But you have assumed the facts of the case, sir. I will not submit to such degradation."
"Very well. Let's get on with it."
"I do not intend to hurt you unless I do so clearly in self-defense. Though if it is necessary, I could split you from the crown of your head to the end of your backbone."
Lincoln swings his broadsword through the air and cleaves a branch from a nearby tree. Shields' eyes widen, but he steels himself.
"I cannot allow such lies as you wrote to stand. You implied that I am full of conceit. You put words in my mouth I would never dare to speak. Here, I quote from your letter. Remember, it is not my fault that I am so handsome and so interesting. I will defend my character against such debasement."
"If you insist."
But before the fight between Lincoln and Shields can go any further, two men rush into the clearing and stand between the duelers, John Hardin and Dr. Revel English. They're mutual friends of both men, and they intend to stop them from making a grave mistake. Hardin pleads with them both.
"Gentlemen, please, can I not persuade you to put down your weapons and resolve this matter peacefully?"
Hardin moves in close to Mr. Shields. He speaks to him in a calming, gentle voice.
"Mr. Shields, why not withdraw your insulting note to Mr. Lincoln? Then we can all go home, please, sir."
Shields grips the hilt of his sword tightly. He considers Hardin's plea. To stop now would wound his honor, but from the look on Mr. Lincoln's face, to go forward would surely end in bloodshed. And from the way Lincoln deftly dismembered that tree limb, Shields has reason to doubt it would be Lincoln's blood. So Shields steps forward and tosses his sword to the ground.
"I withdraw my note of the 17th and any insults it may have contained."
Hardin turns to Lincoln.
"Mr. Lincoln, can you now disavow any intent of harming Mr. Shields' character?"
Lincoln immediately responds to this rational plea and releases his grip on his weapon.
"I never had any intention of injuring your personal or private character or your standing as a gentleman. I wrote and published these letters solely for political effect. For that, I apologize."
Lincoln and Shields shook hands and walked away from the dueling grounds without a fight. For Lincoln, it was a personal victory. He successfully kept Mary Todd out of the public eye. After that duel, Lincoln vowed to never speak of the episode ever again. Years later, a general asked Lincoln, "Is it true that you once went out to fight a duel and all for the sake of the lady by your side?" Lincoln replied coldly, "I do not deny it, but if you desire my friendship, you will never mention it again."
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Wicked Game is sponsored by Factor. It's been a busy month for me. We launched a new podcast with another one coming soon, all while keeping six others that we work on going strong. So I'll be frank, it's been stressful and time-consuming. What could be a perfect storm of conditions to ruin my healthy eating habits? It's so easy to go grab drive-thru, right? But I didn't, because there's Factor, America's number one ready-to-eat meal kit. Chef-prepared, dietitian-approved, ready-to-eat meals delivered straight to your door with over 35 different options every week to choose from, including keto, calorie smart, vegan, veggie, all the ways you want to eat healthy. And there's even more to enjoy with over 55 nutrition-packed add-ons that'll help make your weekly meal planning even more delicious. And I'm dead serious when I tell you they hit the spot. Not only are they tasty, but satisfying, something you don't often get in nutritious food. Plus, it's all ready in just 2 minutes. No prep, no mess. Perfect for your most busy, stressful times and all the rest, too. Head to factormeals.com/wickedgame50 and use code WICKEDGAME50 to get 50% off. That's code WICKEDGAME50 at factormeals.com/WICKEDGAME50 to get 50% off. From Airship, I'm Lindsey Graham, and this is American Elections Wicked Game. Nearly 20 years after vowing to never duel again, Lincoln entered a different kind of fight. In the late 1850s, the country was bitterly divided over the issue of slavery. Some argued slavery should expand to the recently acquired Western states, while others argued that it should be contained to the South. And a few extreme voices called for its abolition altogether. Lincoln stepped into this debate as a moderate. He did not advocate for slavery's abolition where it existed already. But he argued that slavery should not be allowed to spread into the national territories and to overrun us here in these free states. Let us have faith that right makes might, and in that faith, let us to the end dare to do our duty as we understand it. But in this stance, Lincoln faced strong opposition. The powerful Democratic Party and its influential senator, Stephen Douglas. However, as time ticked down to the election of 1860, the Democratic Party began to crack along sectional lines. This election tested not only Lincoln and Douglas, but also the strained ties holding the nation together. This is episode 19, 1860, Lincoln versus Douglas, a house divided. In 1858, Senator Stephen Douglas found himself in an untenable position. He argued that the residents in any U.S. territory should decide for themselves whether to permit or prohibit slavery. This idea, known as popular sovereignty, went against the platform of President James Buchanan and the Democratic Party. But Douglas didn't back down. He directly challenged his party and his president by refusing to ratify the Kansas-Lecompton Constitution in early 1858. Although most Kansas Territory residents opposed slavery, a minority of pro-slavery settlers gathered in Lecompton, wrote a pro-slavery state constitution, and applied for statehood. Buchanan backed the rogue constitution, hoping to appease Southern Democrats by admitting yet another slave state. But this document clearly violated Douglas's popular sovereignty principles. He said, "I cared not whether slavery was voted up or down, but the decision was not the act and deed of the people of Kansas and did not embody their will." So Douglas voted against the Lecompton Constitution. This earned him points with his constituents in Illinois, but not with Democratic Party leaders. Some in the newly founded Republican Party thought that Douglas was making a move to join their nascent faction. Abraham Lincoln believed that the rift between Douglas and the Democrats was only temporary. He said, "Clearly he is not now with us. He does not pretend to be. He does not promise to ever be." But Republican Party leaders believed it was time to oust Douglas from his powerful Senate seat while his back was against the wall with the Democrats. In June 1858, Republican Illinois state delegates officially selected Abraham Lincoln as their candidate to challenge Douglas in the Senate race. Lincoln accepted the nomination on the evening of June 16th. He declared that Douglass's principle of popular sovereignty agitated the slavery issue and set the nation on a course for war. He said, "In my opinion, it will not cease until a crisis shall have been reached and passed. A house divided against itself cannot stand. I believe this government cannot endure, permanently half slave and half free. I do not expect the house to fall, but I do not expect it will cease to be divided. It will become all one thing or all the other." Lincoln's famed "A House Divided" speech kicked off the race for the coveted Illinois Senate seat, a race that was almost entirely focused on slavery. It's the afternoon of August 27, 1858, in Freeport, Illinois. Abraham Lincoln stands at the front of a wooden platform. Douglas, the debate moderators, and a stenographer sit behind him. Lincoln looks at the 15,000 people who have gathered to hear the second debate between Douglas and himself. Lincoln addresses the crowd.
"Fellow citizens, on Saturday last, Douglas and myself first met in public discussion. I now propose that I will answer his interrogatories upon condition that he will answer questions from me."
Lincoln looks over his shoulder at Douglas, who shifts in his seat. But he doesn't say a word, so Lincoln presses on.
"Douglas remains silent. I now proceed to ask the judge the interrogatories, so far as I have framed them."
Lincoln pulls from his pocket a piece of paper with several questions and grills Douglas.
"Can the people of a United States territory in any lawful way exclude slavery from its limits prior to the formation of a state constitution?"
Lincoln doesn't wait for Douglas to answer, though. He keeps going.
"If the Supreme Court shall decide that states cannot exclude slavery from their limits, will you follow their decision?"
Lincoln is becoming more energetic as he builds to the main thrust of his argument. He answers his own question.
"Douglas claims that the people of a territory should have the power to exclude slavery if they see fit, but he voted down a bill which would guarantee that right. He left room thereby for this Dred Scott decision, which goes very far to make slavery national throughout the United States."
Lincoln finally yields the floor and gives Douglas a chance to answer. The crowd jeers as the Democratic debater stands.
"I answer emphatically that, in my opinion, it matters not what the Supreme Court may decide as to the abstract question whether slavery may or may not go into a territory."
Douglas is referring to the same Supreme Court decision, Dred Scott v. Sanford. The 1857 ruling said that slave owners have the right to take their slave property into any U.S. territory, and citizens in a territory cannot lawfully prohibit slavery. Douglas preaches to the crowd a familiar theme for him, popular sovereignty.
"The people have the lawful means to introduce it or exclude it as they please. Slavery cannot exist a day or an hour anywhere unless it is supported by local police regulations. Hence, no matter what the decision of the Supreme Court may be on that abstract question, still the right of the people to make a slave territory or a free territory is perfect and complete."
Finally, Douglas turns to Lincoln and answers his question directly.
"As to whether or not the Supreme Court shall decide to prevent states from banning slavery, such a thought is ridiculous. The Supreme Court would never invade the sovereignty of the states. It would be an act of treason that no man on the bench could ever dissent to."
But just then, a heckler from the crowd calls out,
"The same was said about the Dred Scott decision before it was passed."
Douglas ignores this uncomfortable counterargument. To deflect, he launches an attack on Lincoln.
"In Mr. Lincoln's House Divided speech, he tells you the Union cannot exist unless the states are all free or all slave. He tells you that he is opposed to making them all slave, and hence he is for making them all free. I ask you if that is fair dealing."
Lincoln stands to defend himself. He removes his cloak and hands it to a nearby debate organizer. He leans in close and says,
"Here, hold my clothes while I stone Stephen."
Lincoln spoke for 30 minutes, rebutting Douglas's attack. Soon after, the Freeport debate came to an end. But Douglas's strong arguments for popular sovereignty would live on, coming to be known as the Freeport Doctrine. This doctrine would become the backbone of Douglas's campaign in the election of 1860 and his greatest weapon against Abraham Lincoln. That debate at Freeport, Illinois, was the second of seven Lincoln-Douglas debates. In June 1858, at the outset of his campaign for the contested Illinois Senate seat, Lincoln asked Douglas to participate in a series of public discussions to be held all over the state. It was a brilliant idea. It gave Lincoln a chance to expound on his platform while pointing out the weaknesses in Douglas's position. But it also gave Douglas the opportunity to do the same to Lincoln. Stephen Douglas, as the incumbent senator, had a national reputation, but Lincoln made a fierce competitor. On hearing of Lincoln's nomination, Douglas told a political ally, "I shall have my hands full." So Douglas agreed to publicly debate Lincoln in an effort to wrong-foot the Republican candidate and strengthen his own position. The debate started at Ottawa, Illinois, on August 21, 1858, a mere 10 weeks before the November 2 election. Thousands of people clogged the streets in the small central Illinois town to hear the men speak. Douglas began the debate with a forceful accusation against Lincoln and the Republicans. Douglas claimed that Lincoln and the Republican Party leadership had lured away former Whigs and Democrats into an abolition party under the mane and disguise of a Republican Party. For 1858, this was a serious accusation. Most Americans, whether Republican or Democrat, were not abolitionists. Abolitionists were extremists of their day, advocating for the ending of slavery and allowing former slaves to integrate into white American society, a radical view for the time. Their position went against racist views held by the majority of Americans, and by painting Lincoln as an abolitionist, Douglas undercut Lincoln's standing as a moderate. Douglas also made sure to distance himself from the abolitionist camp. He firmly declared, "I believe this government was made by white men, for the benefit of white men and their posterity forever, and I am in favor of confining citizenship to white men, men of European birth and descent, instead of conferring it upon Negroes." This argument appealed to most Americans, who, whether they agreed with slavery or not, did not want to extend citizenship or voting rights to free blacks. In response to Douglas's arguments, Lincoln took a more moderate position. He did not support abolition, but argued for containing slavery to the states where it already existed. Lincoln, like many Republicans, believed this containment would slowly kill slavery. Lincoln also argued against Douglas's claim that the Constitution was for white men and their posterity. He said, "Douglas is blowing out the moral lights around us. The authors of the Declaration of Independence did not mean to assert the obvious untruth, that all were then actually enjoying that equality. They meant to set up a standard maxim for free society, which should be constantly looked to, augmenting the value of life to all people of all colors everywhere." Across the next six debates, both Douglas and Lincoln laid out their positions on slavery and its expansion. Lincoln often stumbled on his words, spoke slowly, and failed to sway the crowd to his side. The little giant Douglas took advantage of this and argued strongly for his Freeport Doctrine. Douglas claimed that Western settlers could skirt around the Dred Scott Supreme Court ruling by not enacting or enforcing any legal protections for slavery in their territory. This appealed to many Illinois voters. But at their last meeting in Alton on October 15, 1858, Lincoln made a final argument against slavery. He asserted, "Republicans look upon slavery as being a moral, social, and political wrong. And while they contemplate it as such, they nevertheless have due regard for its actual existence among us. Yet having a due regard for these, they desire to make provision that it shall grow no larger." The crowd at Alton burst into applause. And after the applause died down, Lincoln got to the crux of the matter, telling the crowd, "It is the same spirit that says, you work and toil and earn bread, and I'll eat it, no matter in what shape it comes, whether from the mouth of a king who seeks to bestride the people of his own nation and live by the fruit of their labor, or from one race of men as an apology for enslaving another race. It is the same tyrannical principle." Lincoln's message was clear. Slavery is a moral wrong. But the question was left to the Illinoisans, who cast their ballots on a cold, rainy November 2, 1858. But they didn't vote directly for Lincoln or Douglas. The people elected state legislators, and those legislators voted for a senator. In the end, Republicans won a majority of the statewide popular vote, but Democrats won a majority of seats in the Illinois state legislature. And those state representatives chose a fellow Democratic man to represent them in Washington, Stephen Douglas. Lincoln was disappointed, but he told a friend, "I'm glad I made the late race. It gave me a hearing on the great and durable question of the age." Douglas had won the senatorial battle, but Lincoln knew that another blow-up was coming. He was determined to beat Douglas
in the presidential contest of 1860. Wicked Game is sponsored by NetSuite. Here's some quick and easy math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more profit you have and the more money you keep. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more these days. So to reduce costs and the headaches associated with them, switch to NetSuite, the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR, all into one platform and one source of truth. And with NetSuite, you'll also reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud, no hardware required, and accessible from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because now you've got one unified business management suite. And you improve efficiency by bringing all of your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move, so do the math for yourself. See how you'll profit with NetSuite this year. Now through April 15th, NetSuite is offering a one-of-a-kind flexible financing program. Head to netsuite.com/elections. That's netsuite.com/elections, netsuite.com/elections. Did you know you can skip ads and promos like these and listen to all episodes of American Elections Wicked Game without interruption by subscribing at intohistory.com? And not only will you be getting the whole series ad-free and bingeable, but you also get access to over a dozen more incredible history podcasts, also all ad-free, like Wild West Extravaganza, a journey back to the fascinating, tumultuous, and often violent world of the American Old West. From famous outlaws like Billy the Kid and Jesse James to lawmen like Wyatt Earp and Wild Bill Hickok to trailblazing pioneers and frontiersmen, Wild West Extravaganza tells the true stories of the real-life characters who shaped this iconic era. So saddle up and discover the true history of the American frontier, the good, the bad, and the ugly, ad-free at intohistory.com. It's Monday, April 30th, 1860, in Charleston, South Carolina's Institute Hall. The Democratic National Convention delegates have just heard North Carolina's William Avery present two platforms. The majority platform asserts that the federal government should protect slavery in the territories despite the wishes of territorial residents. The minority disagrees, favoring Stephen Douglas's Freeport Doctrine of Popular Sovereignty. After both platforms are presented, the convention floor erupts into a heated debate. Ohio delegate Henry Payne stands at the podium to defend the minority platform.
Gentlemen of the South, do not saddle us, your northern brothers, with more weight. We cannot bend to your demands for slavery protections again. As to popular sovereignty in the territories, we will never recede from that doctrine. Never, 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 so help us God.
Alabama delegate William Yancey stands to rebut this argument.
We Southerners have had enough of Stephen Douglas and his Freeport Doctrine. It is time that Northern Democrats take a stand to protect their Southern brothers' constitutional rights to property. This is indeed the price we demand, or else we will—
You ask too much, sir.
Before Yancey can get a chance to finish his threat, Ohio delegate George Pugh cuts him off and forcefully takes the podium.
You are asking Northern Democrats to eat dust. Gentlemen of the South, you mistake us. You mistake us. We will not do it. You say the only way Southerners will remain at this convention is that Northerners adopt the majority platform. We refuse. So leave if you must. And good riddance to you. Northern Democrats will no longer bend to the beck and bidding of the South.
Quickly, the convention falls into pandemonium. Hundreds of delegates from both sides of the argument vie for the floor. It's nearly a riot, but finally the hall is brought to order. The delegates officially vote to adopt the minority pro-Freeport Doctrine platform, 165-138. After the result is announced, aging Alabama delegate Pope Walker quietly shuffles to the podium. He addresses the crowd.
The Alabama delegation is retiring. Justice has not been done by the South. Never again will any representation from the state of Alabama grace this convention.
Stunned, delegates from the North and South look on silently as the entire Alabama delegation walks out of the hall in protest. Mississippian delegate D.C. Glenn stands and breaks the silence.
It is time that the Yankees must go their ways and the South must go her ways.
Our enemies may hallucinate that Mississippi and Alabama depart by their lonely selves, like Hagar in the wilderness. But in less than 60 days, you will find a united South standing shoulder to shoulder.
With Glenn's statement, the Mississippians followed the Alabama delegation out of the hall. Delegates from Louisiana left shortly after, along with representatives from South Carolina, Florida, Texas, and Arkansas. At their national convention, Democrats fractured along sectional lines. They failed to nominate a presidential candidate. And after the slew of Southern delegates walked out, they no longer had the numbers to do so. Party leaders closed the convention and made a plan to reconvene in Baltimore 2 months later. They hoped cooler heads would prevail and that the Southern states would return to the fold. In the end, though, it would be just wishful thinking. In early 1860, Stephen Douglas still had enough clout within his party and on the national stage to garner support as the Democratic Party's presidential candidate. Despite his break with President Buchanan over the Kansas-Lecompton Constitution and his support of the Freeport Doctrine, many delegates went into the Democratic National Convention expecting to nominate Stephen Douglas, the powerful senator from Illinois, for their party's ticket. But after the Southern delegates walked out of the April convention, Northern and Southern Democrats realized just how deep the divide between them was. Many Northern Democrats felt coerced by Southerners, who asked them to bow to slaveholders' interests again and again. One delegate ranted, "After all the battles we have fought for the South, they only wish to rule us or ruin us." Many Southern Democrats felt that their state and property rights were being stomped on by Northern-friendly policies like the Freeport Doctrine. Mississippi Senator Albert Gallatin Brown forcefully argued for slavery protections in U.S. territories. "What I demand is protection, that protection which you admit we are entitled to by the common Constitution. Give it to us now. Do it at once." Mississippi's other senator, Jefferson Davis, took a more moderate position. He explained that all property requires protection. However, slave owners' right to protection does not necessarily involve the enactment of additional laws. Instead, Davis thought the court should intervene if necessary on a slave owner's behalf, thus creating legal precedents that favored slavery. But even this moderate position wasn't enough to bridge the gap between Northern and Southern Democrats. The party didn't officially break apart, but they splintered into two factions and each nominated their own candidate. In June, Northern Democrats backed Stephen Douglas and adopted his Freeport Doctrine of popular sovereignty as a platform plank. Douglas accepted the nomination and avowed he would fight against two sectional hostile parties, each struggling to use federal power and authority for the aggrandizement of its own section at the expense of the equal rights of the other. Southern Democrats nominated President Buchanan's vice president, John Breckinridge. Breckinridge was a staunch proponent of slavery protection and promised to crush out what little life there is still left in popular sovereignty and its twin brother, unfriendly legislation. This schism in the Democratic Party worried a few Southern voters. In running two candidates, the Democrats split their voting pool and opened a door for the mostly Northern Republican Party. A full anti-slavery man could end up in the White House. A pro-Douglas newspaper editor wrote, "If the Democratic Party breaks to pieces, we can discover no bulwark to the encroachment of Republican fanaticism, and therefore no safety to the South." But in the North, Lincoln also faced an uphill battle to secure the Republican Party's nomination. So he went on a lecture tour to advertise and solidify his position on a myriad of issues, but mainly slavery. By 1860, Lincoln was a prosperous lawyer, married to a cultured Kentucky socialite, and living in relative comfort and ease. But to the people, he remained relatable. Lincoln never forgot his hard-scrabble life as a child, and spoke to potential voters with a country charm and simplicity they appreciated. On March 5, 1860, Lincoln delivered one of his lectures to a large crowd at Hartford, Connecticut's City Hall. There, he told a hypothetical story of himself as a father who found snakes lying in the bed where his children slept. While the audience listened attentively, Lincoln explained that he might try to crush the snake with a stick, but that would make the problem worse. Lincoln explained, "I might hurt the children more than the snake, and it might bite them." The audience gasped and nodded. Lincoln continued, "But if there were a bed newly made up to which the children were to be taken, and it was proposed to take a batch of young snakes and put them there with them,
I take it no man would say there was any question as to how I ought to decide. A member of the audience cried out, "Of course not." The crowd caught on to the metaphor, and Lincoln hammered his point home. The new territories are the newly made bed to which our children are to go. It lies with the nation to say whether they shall have snakes mixed up with them or not. As Lincoln finished his speech, the crowd erupted into cheers. Through this clear illustration, Lincoln had acknowledged the protection of slavery in the states where it already existed, while explaining why it would be dangerous to future generations of Americans to allow it to spread into the territories. One newspaper writer in Hartford observed that when Lincoln spoke, it was as if the people were listening to their own thinking out loud. Another wrote that the tall Illinois lawyer was an effective speaker because he is earnest, strong, honest, simple in style, and clear as crystal in his logic. The lecture tour was a success for Lincoln, and on Thursday, May 17, 1860, he received the presidential nomination from the Republican Party. He beat out powerful frontrunners and nationally known names like William Henry Seward and Salmon Chase because of his moderate, unwavering anti-slavery views, his relatability, and as historian Doris Kearns Goodwin has noted, his political intuition. After Lincoln, Douglas, and Breckinridge officially put their hats in the ring, a fourth candidate entered the race. A third party committed to the Union, the Constitution, and ignoring slavery, the Constitutional Unionists, nominated Tennessee Senator John Bell. This four-way contest, like the United States itself, was divided on sectional lines. In the North, Douglas campaigned against Lincoln. In the South, Bell campaigned against Breckinridge. Lincoln followed the precedent established by George Washington and did not campaign for himself. He invited other Republicans to give speeches on his behalf, and many did. Even previous political rival William Henry Seward publicly endorsed Lincoln. But Lincoln didn't stay silent. Behind the scenes, he wrote letters to political allies asking for news from critical states like Indiana, Pennsylvania, and New York, and exchanged notes with supporters. In October, 11-year-old Grace Bedell wrote to him, and Lincoln took her campaign criticism seriously. The young girl suggested that he grow a beard, stating, "For your face is so thin, and all the ladies like whiskers." Lincoln immediately complied. Meanwhile, Douglas knew he faced the contest of his career and went on a national campaign tour. He gave stump speeches from New England to the Deep South. Though exhausted, Douglas traveled west in October to campaign in Iowa. While there, he heard about Republican victories in early local elections in Indiana and Pennsylvania. The astute politician knew what this meant for his presidential run. He told a friend, "Mr. Lincoln is the next president. We must try to save the Union. I will go south." And so for the last few weeks of the election, Douglas campaigned not for himself, but for his version of the country. Having seen the splintering of his own party just a few months earlier, he took seriously Southern threats to secede if anti-slavery Lincoln was elected. In Alabama, Douglas told a gathering of Democrats, "I believe there is a conspiracy on foot to break up this Union. It is the duty of every good citizen to frustrate the scheme. If Lincoln is elected, he must be inaugurated." Despite Douglas's prediction, though, Lincoln's path to the presidency was by no means a foregone conclusion. Southern states were so set against him, his name did not even appear on 9 slave state ballots. And Lincoln knew that if Douglas could capture support in states with large electoral votes like New York, Douglas, the little giant, could win the election. On November 6, 1860, polls across America opened to voters. Lincoln sat in his Springfield, Illinois office with several friends. He spoke casually with visitors and asked about local election results. Lincoln asked one man named Mr. Herndon, "Who do you think should win the district attorneyship of Sangamon County?" Herndon replied, "I'm not sure, sir. They say it will be a close race. Are you not sure, Mr. Lincoln, that you shouldn't cast a ballot yourself?" Lincoln resisted, saying, "Oh no, the candidate for a presidential office ought not to vote for his own electors." Herndon, though, pressed the case. "Well, of course, but consider you might cut off the top of your ballot and merely vote in the local elections." Lincoln paused and thought about this before replying, "You may be right, Mr. Herndon. I think I will go to the polls this afternoon." So Lincoln became one of millions of voting men across the United States. On that election day, 1860, over 80% of the electorate cast their ballot. members of all parties came out in droves to make their voice heard on the issue of slavery expansion. Soon, election results traveled across telegraph lines to Lincoln in Springfield. His calm attitude from earlier in the day was replaced with a nervous energy. It wasn't until nearly midnight that results from the last free state, New York, became official. Usually a bastion of Democratic power, the Empire State cast all 35 of its electoral votes for Lincoln. This gave Lincoln 180 electoral votes, 28 more than he needed to get a majority and win the election. When the telegram declaring the results from New York came in, Lincoln was at a small dinner party organized by the Republican officials. He immediately took the small piece of paper and went home to tell his wife, Mary, the news. Despite the late hour, Lincoln walked into his house and called out, "Mary, Mary, we are elected." At final count, Lincoln swept all but three electoral votes from the free states, making him the clear winner in this four-way contest. He also won 53.9% of the popular vote in the North. The vote count in the South told a different story. In the 15 slave states, Lincoln received only 2.1% of the vote, not a single electoral vote. Taken together, Lincoln didn't win even 40% of the national popular vote. A pro-Lincoln political cartoon published a few weeks before the election portrayed Douglas, Breckinridge, and Bell trying to break into the White House and Lincoln running to stop them. The drawing depicted Breckinridge trying to scale the side of the building, crying out, "I'm too weak to get up, and I shall be compelled to dissolve the Union." But on the morning of Wednesday, November 7th, the day after the election, Southerners awoke to a Republican president-elect, and a few South Carolinians decided to do what a fictional Breckinridge couldn't. Icebergs, jagged rocks and rocky straits, mutinies, misfortune, and broadside battles. There are more tales of the sea than survivors to tell them, but the podcast Shipwrecks and Sea Dogs is doing a good job, and you can listen to all episodes of that podcast plus many others, including American Election's Wicked Game, without interruption by subscribing at intohistory.com. Shipwrecks and Sea Dogs is one of my favorites from last year, a podcast about the greatest mishaps, misfortune, and misadventures of the sea. You'll hear stories of corruption, greed, bad intentions, and just plain horrible decision-making that resulted in some of the worst maritime disasters from all over the world. And some of these are more recent than you think. All episodes are ad-free, including bonus content and more, at intohistory.com. Subscribe now at intohistory.com. Did you know you can skip ads and promos like these and listen to all episodes of American Election's Wicked Game without interruption by subscribing at intohistory.com? And not only will you be getting the whole series ad-free and bingeable, but you also get access to over a dozen more incredible history podcasts, also ad-free, like Her Half of History. Because even though Hillary Clinton may not have made history when she ran for president in 2016, there have always been women who seized power, spied for their country, created artistic masterpieces, even escaped slavery. Her Half of History is perfect for all those who sat in history class and wondered, what were the women doing all this time? Because the answer is a lot. Get Her Half of History, Wicked Game, and many others ad-free at intohistory.com. Subscribe now at intohistory.com. It's 6:45 p.m. on December 20th, 1860, in Charleston, South Carolina. A balmy evening breeze rustles the palm trees outside of Institute Hall, where only 8 months ago, Alabama delegates stormed out from the Democratic National Convention over the issue of slavery. A group of wealthy men approach the hall with gas street lamps lighting their way. These men are here for a historic occasion. Only 2 days ago, they unanimously approved a secession ordinance, and tonight, they will sign it. The Secession Convention president, David Jamison, carries the official copy of the ordinance into the building, followed by 168 delegates. Already inside, some 3,000 citizens wait for the delegates to arrive. Reverend John Bachman opens the meeting with a prayer. Our gracious Lord, bless those that gather here with wisdom and the opportunity to protect and bless the humble race that has been entrusted to our care. Amen. After Bachman's prayer, Convention President Jamison steps forward and reads the secession ordinance to the crowd. We, the people of the state of South Carolina, in convention assembled, do declare and ordain
that the union now subsisting between South Carolina and other states under the name the United States of America is hereby dissolved.
As the crowd roars its approval, Clerk John Sloan calls each delegate up to a large table flanked by two potted palmetto trees to sign the document.
Edward Noble, David Wardlaw, John Calhoun.
Each man quietly walks to the front of the assembly hall and affixes his signature to the linen parchment. And with each name, the cheers grow louder.
Benjamin Lawton, Thomas Moore, John Middleton.
The signing ceremony proceeds without interruption until a delegate from Beaufort County is called.
Robert Barnwell Rhett.
Rhett is a lifelong advocate for states' rights and slavery protections. His passionate calls for secession have branded him a fire eater. He comes to the table, but before he signs the document, he kneels to pray.
Holy Father, I thank thee for this glorious occasion. Now I offer gratitude that these last 30 years of my work finished in this triumph. Amen.
Rhett then signs, and the proceedings continue. At 9:15 p.m., Convention President Jameson officially ends the meeting.
Gentlemen, at the start of this convention, I urged you to dare, and again to dare, and without end to dare. I congratulate you. As you have placed your signatures on this historic document, I declare the state of South Carolina an independent commonwealth.
The crowd erupts into cheers as the delegates rush to the front of the hall to celebrate with one another. Eager for a memento of such an occasion, the delegates tear the soft pieces of bark from the two palmetto trees. The hall can't contain the jubilation, and the throng spills into the streets. An impromptu parade of bands, rifle companies, and revelers marches into the night. In their wake, they leave behind two denuded palmettos and a nation torn in two. By February 1st, 1861, Mississippi, Florida, Alabama, Georgia, Louisiana, and Texas also seceded from the Union. These seven states formed the Confederate States of America and appointed Jefferson Davis as interim president. They left the Union in large part as a response to Lincoln's election. The president-elect hoped to bring them back into the fold before violence could erupt. But threats of violence appeared earlier than Lincoln expected. As he traveled with his family from Springfield to Washington, D.C., two detectives traveling with him got wind of a credible threat on Lincoln's life and insisted on a change of plans. Mary and his boys, Willie and Tad, would take the 4 o'clock train into the capital city on February 25th, but Lincoln would ride overnight and arrive under cover of darkness the night before his family. Lincoln reluctantly agreed. In the end, this plan kept him safe, but at a political cost. One Democrat wrote, "This surreptitious nocturnal dodging or sneaking of the president-elect into his capital city under cloud of night will be used to damage his moral position and throw ridicule on his administration." Lincoln weathered the storm of gossip and derision. He focused his energy on finding a way to win over the seceded states and prevent more slave states from joining them. The day after he arrived in Washington, Lincoln gave a draft of his inaugural address to William Henry Seward. Seward saw a few glaring errors. In Seward's opinion, the speech was too threatening and would encourage other slave states to leave the Union. Lincoln needed to assuage the fears of Southerners. Lincoln had campaigned on a promise to leave slavery alone where it existed already. But clearly, seven slave states didn't believe him. Seward advised that Lincoln use conciliatory language and offer an olive branch to the seven Confederated states and the border states still tenuously tied to the Union. It was good advice, and Lincoln took it, demonstrating one of his greatest strengths throughout his presidency, the ability to listen and concede to experts. Lincoln changed several points in his speech. The Confederacy had begun to seize U.S. forts and arsenals within their borders. Lincoln originally had threatened, "All the power at my disposal will be used to reclaim the public property and places which have fallen, to hold, occupy, and possess these, and all of the property and places belonging to the government." But as Seward advised, Lincoln softened this to, "The power confided to me will be used to hold, occupy, and possess the property and places belonging to the government." Lincoln edited the speech until late into the night of March 3rd, ensuring that his vital inaugural address will be ready for the next day. On March 4th, 1861, Lincoln stood at the stoop of his temporary quarters, the Willard Hotel, with President Buchanan. They climbed into a carriage that would take them to the Capitol for Lincoln's swearing-in ceremony. Along the way, they passed throngs of well-wishers, and because threats on Lincoln's life still circulated, uniformed soldiers stood in the crowd along with several sharpshooters on the rooftops, looking for anything suspicious. The presidential procession arrived at the Capitol without incident. A platform had been built on the east side of the Capitol steps with seats for the inaugural dignitaries and guests. Lincoln and President Buchanan sat in the first row of chairs with Douglas and Chief Justice Roger Taney. Mary, Robert, Willie, and Tad Lincoln sat in the next row. Lincoln's longtime friend, Senator Edward Baker, stood at the small table acting as a podium and introduced the president-elect to the nearly 30,000 people gathered to witness the event. Lincoln stood and came to the table. He fumbled with his papers and his hat. There was not enough room for both on the small stand table. Douglas stood and politely offered to hold the hat, quipping as he sat down, "Well, if I can't be president, at least I can hold the president's hat." Soon after, Lincoln began his speech. Apprehension seems to exist among the people of the southern states that by the ascension of a Republican administration, their property and their peace and their personal security are to be endangered. I declare that I have no purpose, directly or indirectly, to interfere with the institution of slavery in the states where it exists. Lincoln spoke of peace, of loyalty to the Constitution, and closed with a call for unity. We are not enemies, but friends. We must not be enemies. Though passion may have strained, it must not break our bonds of affection. The mystic cords of memory, stretching from every battlefield and patriot grave to every living heart and heart stone all over this broad land, will yet swell the chorus of the Union when again touched, as surely they will be, by the better angels of our nature. The crowd cheered as Lincoln finished. Chief Justice Roger Taney stood and administered the oath of office. Lincoln raised his right hand and promised, "I do solemnly swear that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States." The crowd cheered once more. Douglas handed Lincoln's hat back to him, but Douglas's graciousness in losing the election and his polite gesture didn't calm the fears of Southerners, nor did Lincoln's call for unity and reconciliation. The Richmond Dispatch concluded that Lincoln's speech inaugurated not only a president, but inaugurates civil war. On March 5th, his first day in office, Lincoln received an urgent message from a commander at federally controlled Fort Sumter in Charleston, South Carolina. Major Robert Anderson told the president his supplies were running dangerously low, and the people of Charleston were growing hostile towards the Union soldiers in their midst. Time was running out on a peaceful resolution with the Confederacy. So from his very first day, Lincoln inherited an America at war with itself. The job of stamping out the insurrection and winning the election of 1864 would fall to Lincoln. In pursuit of victory and in his attempt to put the country back together whole, Abraham Lincoln would pay the ultimate price. This is episode 19 of American Election's Wicked Game, 1860, A House Divided. On the next episode, the election of 1864, with flagging popularity and his country losing a war, Abraham Lincoln also battles to keep the country together and to become the first two-term president since Andrew Jackson. If you're a careful Wicked Game listener, you know in the credits, I mentioned my friend Professor Greg Jackson and his podcast, History That Doesn't Suck. It's a great show. But one way it can doesn't suck even more is when you listen to it without ads. You can listen to all episodes of American Election's Wicked Game, all episodes of History That Doesn't Suck, and all episodes of many more great history podcasts without interruption by subscribing at intohistory.com. History That Doesn't Suck is a deeply researched chronological survey of American history from a trained academic who also knows how to tell a story. Plus, in addition to ad-free listening to one of the best American history podcasts out there, you get scores of bonus episodes at intohistory.com. Subscribe now at intohistory.com. This episode contains reenactments and dramatized details, and while in most cases we can't know exactly what was said, all our dramatizations are based on historical research. American Election's Wicked Game is an Airship production, hosted, edited, and executive produced by me, Lindsey Graham. Sound design by Derek Behrens. Music by Lindsey Graham. Co-executive produced by Stephen Walters in association with Ritual Productions. Written and researched by C.L. Salazar. fact-checking by Greg Jackson from the podcast History That Doesn't Suck.